Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Hey, everybody, I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Valerie Fox. She's known for work at IBM Canada, as well as for developing and co-founding the Ryerson DMZ. It's a multidisciplinary workspace, a business incubator, startup accelerator for digital media businesses. We work together as directors with Futurepreneur Canada, but she is also, she's so impressive, the founder and chief innovation consultant at Pivotal Point. Welcome, Val.
Hi, Val. Thanks. I'm very excited to be here.
I'm delighted to have you here. And thank you and welcome to our listeners from around the world, including USA, Ireland, UK, Australia, Italy, and so many more countries. We want our community to grow. So please tell your friends and follow us on Instagram. Thanks also to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, BDC, Lockheed Martin, Export Development Canada, and ADGA. I'm also excited to share that you can now pre-order my Fearless book on Chapters Indigo. Look up Fearless by Janice McDonald at chapters.ca. So Val, I want to start with the fact that you hold multiple patents, including one for the concept of the universal shopping cart, and four patents for the synchronized multi-tablet internet TV system. Wow. Tell us all about this. Is it easy to get patents in Canada? How did this journey of patent holding begin for you?
Well, for me, it was a huge milestone for me when I was at IBM, because I was hired as a designer, a user experience designer, graphic designer for digital enterprise software when I entered the IBM world. And interestingly enough, I always felt like a square peg in a round hole there because of my design experience. And it was a tech company, especially back then, and this is in the 90s. And how I got my first patent, which is the Universal Shopping Cart for the Web, which was in the late 90s.
Which is a big deal. This is such a big deal.
Actually, yeah,
oh my gosh.
In a sense, it was because it was a design idea. And what was interesting is how the patent actually got filed. Because as a designer, the very first thing I needed to do once the idea came to me was I needed to make sure that it could be done. Because I could see it in my head, I understood how it would work, but I needed to talk to my technical buddies at IBM, and that's what I did. And I found out that, yes, indeed, it could be created. And this is the ability to actually buy multiple things from multiple stores right across the web. And what I ended up doing, because I really, even back then, I realized to get things accelerated, I didn't have the credibility at IBM as a designer that a technical person might have. Mm-hmm. And so I enlisted a fantastic guy that I was working with, because I was part of the design consultancy for all of IBM. And his name was Michael D'Angelo. And I told him about the idea. He was very excited about it. And he had written many patents. And together, we actually filed that patent. And it was accepted, and it became one of IBM's top 5% patents in the world for a period of time. So, yeah, I was pretty proud of that.
Yeah, so incredible. And still, four more patents. Synchronized,
yeah,
multi-tablet,
yeah, so
internet,
I was,
TV system.
Oh, it's amazing. But the whole thing, that, if you'd like, I'll tell you about how those came about.
Absolutely.
And that came about while I was the creative director for the Sydney Olympics. And I was in a room which we were surrounded by TV monitors, and yet we were working on our computers. Today, we take all of this stuff for granted. But at the time, we were able to work together using all of these different monitors and together build the experience that we did for the Olympics. And I thought, I wonder whether we could synchronize what was going on in the screens that we were seeing and what we were actually doing on our computers. That's where the idea came from. But again, what I ended up doing was collaborating with a number of my technical buddies at IBM and came up with that patent with them. And we were able to push it through in an accelerated rate. So it was tons of fun. But it was also the tip of the iceberg of where I would say our iPads came from, because we kind of came up with that idea back then.
Mm. So incredible. So let's talk about creativity. How do you unleash it? Because you clearly have no problem coming up with immense and fabulous ideas.
It's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about where does the creativity come from. I think it comes from your experience. I think everyone has a toolkit that they take with them wherever they go. Every experience that they have, they're adding to their toolkit. That's what I do with mine. And so when I see a particular situation and I'm working with others and we're talking about the various aspects of it and through multiple perspectives, because user experience is always how people experience things themselves, when you take all of that into account, I don't, you know, somehow the mind puts these things together and comes up with fantastic ideas. I find my best ideas come from conversations with other people, because we feed on each other and together we can come up with solutions for things.
So what are you up to now? Tell us about your current role and why it matters to you, because you spend your time as chief innovation consultant for Pivotal Point. What does that mean? What are you up to over there, Val?
Well, you know, number one is, I'll say it this way, that I'm in my 60s. I'm just turned 65, and being then, I've had so many different experiences, but it was my experience co-founding the DMZ with Sheldon Levy, who was the then president of Ryerson, that brought to mind the ability of bringing people together to solve great problems and to ensure that the world thrives through entrepreneurship and innovation. We were highly successful, and I'd say a lot of the stuff that I had put in place in creating the DMZ was all based on design principles and how people work together. But what was so great about that experience was we were so successful so quickly that I realized that we need these kinds of environments all over the world. We need them in every town, every city, every academic institution, and every corporation. And we're all part of a giant ecosystem that we can feed from one another. And so this is what enables more and more of us to thrive and be successful in the digital world. In fact, we act like the digital world. I think that I made it my business to ensure that more and more people collaborate, partner. I believe partner is the accelerator of the 21st century, partnership. Mm-hmm. And I believe that by enabling people to create environments for this, we are going to enable the 21st century to be very, very exciting and successful for so many more people.
So I see that partnership is a key value for you. But what about when you have to make tough choices? Do you have a strategy or a specific approach that you use, Val?
Yeah, there's two aspects to that. So tough choices, there is time to make a tough choice. So I'm not talking about an emergency. I'm talking about where there's a tough choice and you've come to a critical path. You need to look through the eyes of all the people that it will affect, and also to talk to people who have had various experiences that can bring those perspectives to bear. I talk to a lot of people, and I use those relationships to enable myself to make those tough decisions. And I also realize when you make tough decisions that it actually affects so many other people, that keep in mind what it's going to do to other people and the tough decisions that they're going to have to make because of those tough decisions. So that's how it works, really, for pretty well every big decision I have to make. However, in an emergency, or when something you have to make a very quick decision for something that's quite critical, this is when your intuition kicks in. And your intuition is made up of that toolkit I was talking about before, mm-hmm. that we create in our lifetime through all of the different experiences that we have. And the intuition kicks in and puts those things together to enable you to make that type of decision. And I use it all the time. I trust my intuition very much.
Mm-hmm. I do as well. So you mentioned you're 65. What's something you wish you knew earlier? Because you know so much, you have so much wisdom, but what's something that, that would have helped me?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about that question as you were asking it, and I was going, what do I wish I knew? And the interesting thing is, and I'm going to say it, I don't know if I wish I knew anything. Like, the thing is, I only know what I know now, and I consider it very little. I rely on the wisdom of others and my own wisdom as I go forward, and again, I trust in it. But if I had known stuff before, then I would screw up later. So on other things. So I make mistakes all the time. I'm going to keep making those mistakes, but I figured that's how we learn. So I figured that's all part of my particular journey.
So you're comfortable then with mistakes, and so to you, you know, there's a discomfort around failure and making mistakes. So that's not true of you. You're okay with it.
No, I've made so many that it's like, no, it's like I expect it. I really expect it. And it's like, oh, yeah, okay. And it's what I learn about it. But, you know, the interesting thing is people say, you know, it's what you learn, what you take from it. But it's not only that. I really think it's communication that comes after. If you screw up, mm-hmm. let people know. Tell people how you screwed up and tell people how you fixed the problem. It's about how you pick yourself up. Mm-hmm. And I've used that adage a lot. And the thing is, I think that a lot of the things that I've been very lucky to be successful at was because I communicate. I tell people when things are messed up, when things are going well, how it might affect them. I want to know how it is affecting them so that I can communicate that to others.
So, Val, your 10-year-old self, what was that girl like? Where did you live? What were you into?
I had a really lucky childhood, and I was quite privileged by that time. My parents were doing pretty well, and at 10, I felt very loved. I have a brother and a sister. I lived on Long Island. I'm from New York, mm-hmm. and my parents, both of them, were very, very supportive of me as a person and of my individuality. They saw that I was very curious. They fed that curiosity. They told me that I could pretty well do anything I wanted to, and they supported me in that. So I think I was quite lucky in that regard. My father was really awesome, especially because he's a 50s dad, and a 50s dad would be the one, you know, you're supposed to get married and have children and stay home and mm-hmm. as a wife and as a mother. And he never said that. He always said he really wanted his girls to be independent and do what they thought they wanted to do, and he would support them in every which way possible. Now, all that was great, and as a 10-year-old, I felt amazingly loved and supported. Puberty was a whole nother mess, and all of those cards kind of fell at puberty, but at 10 years old, I felt pretty good.
Yeah, it's a challenge to make that transition, isn't it? It can be.
Oh, it was really tough. It was tough because also I'm very tall. I come from a family of very, very tall people. My dad, he just passed away recently. He's 92, but he's 6'7", and my brother's 6'5". I'm 6'1". My sister's 5'11". My mom was 5'9". And so we lived in a family of very, very tall people. So not normal, right? So when you go out through puberty and all that kind of stuff, you kind of stick out like a sore thumb. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting transition for me and how to work through that.
And yet you have fabulous posture. You stand tall. So is that...
I do.
Have you always been doing that? You know, because it can be hard when you know you're towering over people. And I think it's harder for a female, or can be harder.
I think it is. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because I've got two grandchildren, one's 11 and one's 9. They are both going to be super tall. My son is 6'7", and my 11-year-old granddaughter is already 5'7". And what's awesome about her is she has way more confidence at age 11 than I did. And I see that that's going to do her, it's going to be really awesome. So I'm really thrilled for her.
And you talked about, so yes, you're a grandmother. What do you want that next generation, those granddaughters to think about?
I want them to think about how fortunate they are and how they can actually make a huge impact on the world, that they're very capable of it. I feel that they can be, especially in the digital world. And the digital world, I think, the 21st century really works about how people work with one another and are considerate of one another, look through each other's eyes and perspectives, and how lucky we are to live in such an incredibly diverse world, so that there are so many perspectives and there are so many cultures. And it's out there to kind of pursue what you love to do, but know that it does impact other people. And I see that they're already conscious of it. I see that how they're already using digital media, how they're already using social media. They seem to be aware of this, and that makes me really happy.
And how do you convey to them the importance of, you know, how they approach their digital life?
Yeah. You know, it does go through my mind because, of course, I worry about privacy and security. I also worry about screen time. Mm-hmm. I see that they use it a lot. It thrills me when they come over because they're on various apps that are an extension of their school. So, for instance, they're doing math homework or they're doing or even challenges that are math challenges, science challenges, and they're writing. So I'm thrilled about that. But then there's also a social aspect of it that makes me a little nervous because they're young and they're impressionable and they seem to really care about, you know, being on their various apps and talking to their friends a lot. But I just think it's just a little different. I think it all has to be worked out over time. So, yeah, I'm concerned because it's an unknown. I don't know how it's going to affect them. I only know that I see a lot of positive about it, that they're going to be being able to connect to people in ways that they never were before, that they have access to knowledge that they never had before. So I see it fairly positive. I just think that, you know, over time, we're going to learn to be a little bit more careful.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about a time that you were fearless. I have the sense this is an everyday activity for you, but can you highlight one? Just pick one, Val.
All right. Well, I have a story to share with you. I hope it's not too long, but it's a good story because when I think back, it was the time that made me sweat the most.
So great.
That's probably a good story to talk, and it's an IBM story. So it has everything to do actually with the Sydney Olympics, and this is back in 1999, going into the year 2000. A huge milestone for everybody, I think. Mm-hmm. And IBM was working with a producer team in Sydney, IBM used to do the Olympics and do all of the technical stuff for it, and also the design. Well, the design team that was in Atlanta, Georgia, was not being looked at favorably by the producing team in Sydney. In fact, it was losing ground, and it was actually hurting the relationship that IBM was having with the producing team in Sydney. And so someone knew about my team. I was working with about 40-odd number of designers in Canada, and they reached me and they said, Val, could you jump on a plane and see if you can salvage the relationship with these people? Well, I had never really done anything as large as an Olympic site or anything like that, and I was honored that I was asked to do that. And it was kind of scary. I had 1 week to turn it around. And so I jumped on a plane with an art director, Angelica Rother. I was the creative director. And we go and we meet the team, and the producer's name was Mel. And Mel and I hit it off. Like, I thought we got along really well. She explained what she wanted to do. Her team explained. And together, Ange and I worked on that for about 3 days. And at the end of the 3 days, we thought, oh, man, we really nailed this. We used the technology at the time. We figured we got the best possible design, and we were thrilled to show it to them. And so we show it to Mel and her team, waiting for, you know, the trumpets to go, and we just figured we really nailed it, and they hated it. They absolutely hated it. And Mel said, obviously, you didn't listen to a thing that we said. This is not what we wanted at all. And she was very upset. And I was flabbergasted. I thought, I'm not used to people not liking what we were doing. And I was so sure we were right. So I pulled Mel aside from her team and I said, listen, obviously we screwed up. We didn't hear what you wanted. Please come to our hotel room tomorrow with your team and bring any kind of illustration or anything you can to help us see through your eyes so we know what you want and we'll design it. And so that's what happened. The next day, they came to our hotel room. There were three of them. So we're in our little hotel room. We've got all these people, and they bring all kinds of illustrations, and they're pantomiming all kinds of stuff that they want this site to look like and feel like. And after about 3 hours, they left. And Ange and I got to work, and I said, I want to give them exactly what they're asking for. And Ange said, but we can't do it technically. And I said, I don't care. Let's give them, but they're called mock-ups, so just designs on the screen that what it would look like, not what it was going to act like, but what it was going to look like. And so we did. They wanted very large pictures back there, and in 2000, it would take a day and a half for some illustration to come up on the screen because, you know, we were using our telephone lines. And anyway, we came up with these beautiful, beautiful screens. And Ange was quite nervous, and I said, well, we're going to show it. We had our last day. And so we present it. They love it. They go crazy. Yes, that's exactly what we want. Exactly what we want. They give champagne, and everyone's so excited, except that the technical team in New York was going to kill us because we can't do it. You just can't do what we came up with. I knew it. And so we fly back, and I said, Ange, I'm going to, you know, as soon as the team hears about it, I'm going to get screamed at. So you can be in the room or not, but I'm going to put them on speakerphone. And anyway, that's exactly what happened. They called, and they spent at least 20 minutes, and that they had their team there. There was must have been 15 people in the room calling me every name you can possibly imagine. This is a podcast. I won't use that terrible language that they use.
We get the sense of it,
but they really just took 20 strips out of me. And when they were done, I said, are you done now? Are you kidding? Blah, blah, blah. And they went off again. I said, listen, just stop for a second. And I said, I took a risk. Here's what I did. I said, I know you can't do it. Well, if you knew we couldn't do it, then why? I said, because I really felt that Mel and her team felt that they weren't being listened to. I wanted to show them that we're listening. So I said, so here's what they want. Now, what can you do? And they stopped. They just stopped, and they said, well, give us a day. And they came up with something amazing. It was amazing what they came up with. And then we sent it on back to Mel and her team, and she called me the next day, and she said, Val, what's this? And I said, well, the thing was that we knew that we couldn't do it technically, but I wanted you to know that we were really listening. But this is what we can do. Are you okay with it? And she said, yeah, I'm really happy with it. And that was it.
Wow. That's so inspiring.
It was crazy. Yeah, a lot of sweat.
That's fearless. Absolutely.
That was crazy.
A beautiful
story. I don't know if I could do it again.
Don't need to. Been there, done that. Okay, so final question, Val, and this is the big one. What's your dream for Canada?
So I explained that I'm originally from New York, mm-hmm. and I became a Canadian. So first I want to say that when I became a Canadian, it was one of the most beautiful days of my life. It was a huge highlight, and it just filled me with just feelings of I'm in the right place. And why? Because it's so beautifully diverse. I talk to so many different kinds of people with so many different cultures. It fills me with all kinds of fabulous ideas. I feel like Canada is a place where things can really happen. We actually have an opportunity that most people can't or don't. And so Canada, I want Canada to know the power that it has by this diversity, by the fact that we've learned how to live with people and just utilize what we all know in such a beautiful, beautiful way. And I want us to become more aware of that.
I love that. That's an amazing and beautiful dream for Canada. She's the founder and chief innovation consultant at Pivotal Point. It has been an absolute delight to have Val Fox on the Fearless Woman podcast today. Thank you so much, Val, for joining us.
Hey, it was my pleasure. It's really fun. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, BDC, Lockheed Martin, Export Development Canada, and ADCA. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30%club.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to Export Development Canada, the international risk experts, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. Supporting Canadian companies of all sizes succeed on the world stage. EDC takes your worries away and helps you grow your business with confidence. When your business has no borders, neither does your potential. Find out more at edc.ca/womenintrade. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.